just pulled one out, put it on some folded up toilet paper, then went back in and got another one. Then one more after that. Pretty sure they're spider legs, Orville says. Luther says and laughs, at which point Orville shows him a neat pile of folds of toilet paper. Let me see, Luther says. Orville opens up the folds of toilet paper and shows Luther. What the fuck? Luther says. Right out of my leg, Orville says. Are you sure it's not, like, splinters? Nah, look where the leg bends. There's a joint and a tip, like the end of the leg where it gets skinnier, look. That's fucked up, Luther says. But what about the other five? I mean, if they're spider legs, there should be eight, right? Before Orville can say anything else or put away the spider legs, Luther's on his phone. You looking it up? Orville asks him. But Luther doesn't answer. He just taps. Scrolls. Waits. You find anything? Orville says. Nah, not even a little bit, Luther says. When Lonnie comes out with his bike, Orville and Luther look down at it and nod. Lonnie smiles at their nods. Let's go, Orville says, then puts his earphones in. He looks back and sees his brothers put theirs in too. They ride back toward Wood Street. As they pass the Target sign, Orville remembers last year when they all got phones at Target on the same day as an early Christmas present. They were the cheapest phones they had, but at least they weren't flip phones. They were smart. They do all they need them to do. Make calls, text, play music, and get them on the internet. They ride together in a line and listen to what comes out of their phones. Orville mainly listens to powwow music. There's something in the energy of that big booming drum, in the intensity of the singing, like an urgency that feels specifically Indian. He likes the power the sound of a chorus of voices makes too. Those high-pitched wailed harmonies, how you can't tell how many singers there are, and how sometimes it sounds like 10 singers, sometimes like 100. There was even one time, when he was dancing in Opal's room with his eyes closed, when he felt like it was all his ancestors who made it so he could be there dancing and listening to that sound, singing right there in his ears through all those hard years they made it through. But that moment was also the first time his brothers saw him in regalia, dancing like that. They walked in on him in the middle of it, and they thought it was hilarious. They laughed and laughed, but promised not to tell Opal. As for Luther, not counting himself, he listens exclusively to three rappers: Chance the Rapper, Eminem, and Earl Sweatshirt. Luther writes and records his own raps to instrumentals he finds on YouTube, and makes Orville and Lonnie listen to them and agree with him about how good he is. As for Lonnie, they'd recently discovered what he's into. You hear that? Luther had asked one night in their room. Yeah, it's like some kind of chorus or choir, right? Orville said. Yeah, like angels or some shit, Luther said. Angels, Orville said. Yeah, like what they have them sound like. What they have them sound like? I mean like movies and shit, Luther said. Shut up. It's still going. Listen. They sat for the next couple of minutes and listened to the distant sound of the symphony, of the choir coming through an inch of speaker muted by Lonnie's ears, ready to believe it was anything, anything better than the sound they had the angels make. It hit Orville first what the sound was, and he started to say Lonnie's name, but Luther got up, put a finger to his lips, then went over and gently pulled Lonnie's earphones out. He put one of them close to his ear and smiled. He looked at Lonnie's phone and smiled bigger and showed it to Orville. Beethoven? Orville said. They ride up 14th toward downtown. 14th takes them through downtown to East 12th, which gets them to the Fruitvale without a bike lane, but on a street big enough so that even though cars get comfortable, swerve a little, and go faster on East 12th, it's better than riding the gutter edge of International Boulevard. When they get to Fruitvale and International, they stop in the Wendy's parking lot. Orville and Luther take out their phones. Guys, seriously? Orville had spider legs in his leg? What the fuck? Lonnie asks. Orville and Luther look at each other and laugh hard. Lonnie hardly ever curses, so when he does, it's always both super serious and funny to hear. Come on, Lonnie says. It's real, Lonnie, Orville says. What does that mean, it's real, Lonnie says. We don't know, Orville says. Call Grandma, Lonnie says. And say what, Luther says. Tell her, Lonnie says. She'll make it a big deal, Orville says. What'd the internet say? Lonnie asks. Luther just shakes his head. Seems Indian, Orville says. What? Luther says. Spiders and shit, Orville says. Definitely Indian, Lonnie says. Maybe you should call, Luther says. Fuck, Orville says. But the powwow's tomorrow. What does that have to do with it? Luther says. You're right, Orville says. It's not like she knows we're going. Orville leaves a message for his grandma when she doesn't pick up. He tells her they got Lonnie's bike, and then about the spider legs. While he leaves the message, he watches Luther and Lonnie look at the legs together. They poke at the legs and move the toilet paper so that the legs bend. Orville feels a pulse in his stomach, and like something falls out of him. After he hangs up, he takes the legs, folds up the toilet paper, and stuffs it in his pocket. The day of the powwow, Orville wakes up hot. He covers his face with the cold bottom of his pillow. He thinks about the powwow, then lifts the pillow and tilts his head to listen to what he thinks he hears from out in the kitchen. He wants to minimize their time with Opal before they go. He wakes his brothers up by hitting them with his pillow. They both moan and roll over, so he hits them again. We gotta get out without having to talk to her. She might have made us breakfast. We'll tell her we're not hungry. But I am hungry, Lonnie says. Don't we want to hear what she thinks about the spider legs? Luther says. No, Orville says, we don't. Not now. I really don't think she'll care we're going to the powwow, Luther says. Maybe, Orville says. But what if she does? Orville and his brothers ride their bikes down San Leandro Boulevard on the sidewalk in a line. At the Coliseum BART station, they lift their bikes and carry them on their shoulders, then ride across the pedestrian bridge that gets them to the Coliseum. They slow to a roll. Orville looks through the chain-link fence and sees the morning fog clearing to blue. Orville leads his brothers clockwise around the outer edge of the parking lot. He stands and pedals hard and takes off his plain black hat and stuffs it into his hoodie's front pocket. After getting some speed, he stops pedaling, takes his hands off the handlebars, and grabs hold of his hair. It's gotten long, down to the middle of his back long. He ties his hair back with the beaded hair clip that he'd found with the regalia in his grandma's closet. He pulls his ponytail through the half circle in the back of his hat, which latches with the snaps of 6 small black plastic buttons in a line. He likes the sound, the feel of it when he can get them to snap down perfectly in a row. He picks up speed again, then coasts and looks back. Lonnie's in the back with his tongue sticking out from how hard he's pedaling. Luther's taking pictures of the Coliseum with his phone. The Coliseum looks massive, bigger than it looks when you see it from BART or driving by on the freeway. Orville's gonna dance on the same field that the A's and the Raiders play on. He'll compete as a dancer. He'll dance the dance he learned by watching powwow footage on YouTube. It's his first powwow. Can we stop? Lonnie says, out of breath. They stop halfway around the parking lot. I gotta ask you guys something, Lonnie says.
Just ask then, homie, Luther says.
Shut up, Luther.
What's up, Lonnie?
Orville says, looking at Luther.
I've been meaning to ask, Lonnie says. Like, what's a powwow?
Luther laughs, takes off his hat and hits it against his bike. Lonnie, we've seen hella powwows.
What do you mean, what's a powwow? Orville says.
Yeah, but I never asked nobody, Lonnie says. I didn't know what we were looking at. Lonnie tugs at the bill of his black and yellow A's cap to pull his head down. Orville looks up at the sound of a plane passing overhead.
I mean, why does everyone dress up, dance, and sing Indian? Lonnie says.
Lonnie, Luther says, in that way an older brother can take you down by just saying your name.
Never mind, Lonnie says.
No, Orville says.
Every time I ask questions, you guys make me feel stupid for asking, Lonnie says.
Yeah, but, Lonnie, you ask hella stupid questions, Luther says. Sometimes it's hard to know what to say.
Then say it's hard to know what to say, Lonnie says, squeezing his handbrake.
He swallows hard, watching his hand grip the handbrake, then leans down to watch the brakes grip the front tire.
They're just old ways, Lonnie.
Dancing, singing Indian.
We gotta carry it on. Orville says. Why? Lonnie says.
If we don't, they might disappear,
Orville says.
Disappear? Where are they gonna go?
I mean, like, people will forget.
Why can't we just make up our own ways? Lonnie says.
Orville puts his hand across his forehead the same way their grandma does when she's frustrated.
Lonnie, you like the taste of Indian tacos, right? Orville says.
Yeah, Lonnie says.
Would you just make up some food of your own and eat it? Orville says.
That actually sounds pretty fun, Lonnie says, still looking down but smiling a little now, which makes Orville laugh and say the word stupid in the middle of his laugh. Luther laughs too, but he's already looking at his phone. They get back on their bikes, then look up and see lines of cars streaming in, hundreds of people getting out of their cars. The boys stop. Orville gets off his bike. These are other Indians, getting out of their cars. Some of them already in full regalia, real Indians like they'd never seen before, if you didn't count their grandma, who they probably should count, except that it was too hard for them to tell what was specifically Indian about her. She was all they knew besides their mom, who's too hard to think about or remember. Opal worked for the post office, delivered mail. She liked to watch TV when she was home, cook for them. They didn't know much else about her. She did make fry bread for them on special occasions. Orville pulls at the nylon straps of his backpack to tighten it and lets go of the handlebars. Lets the front wheel wobble, but balances by leaning back. In the backpack is the regalia that barely fits, his extra-extra-large black hoodie, which was too big for him on purpose, and three now squished peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in Ziploc plastic baggies he hopes they won't have to eat. But he knows they might have to if the Indian tacos are too expensive. If food prices are anything like the food at A's games when it's not dollar night. They only knew about Indian tacos because their grandma made them for their birthdays. It was one of the few Indian things she did. And she was always sure to remind them that it's not traditional, and that it comes from lacking resources and wanting comfort food. To be sure they'd at least be able to afford an Indian taco each, they rode their bikes up to the fountain behind the Mormon temple. Luther had just been there for a field trip to Joaquin Miller Park, and he said people threw coins in for wishes. They made Lonnie roll up his pants and gather all the coins he could see, while Orville and Luther threw rocks at the community building at the top of the stairs above the fountain. A distraction they didn't see at the time might have been worse than the fountain scraping itself. Going down Lincoln Avenue after that was one of the best and stupidest things they'd ever done together. You could get going so fast down a hill, there was nothing else happening in the whole world but the feeling of the speed moving through you and the wind in your eyes. They went to Bayfair Center and San Leandro and scraped out what they could from that fountain before being chased off by a security guard. They took the bus up to the Lawrence Hall of Science in the Berkeley Hills, where there was a double fountain, which they knew would be practically untouched because only rich people or monitored kids on field trips went to that place. After rolling up all the coins and turning them in at the bank, they came away with a total of $14.91. When they get to the entrance at the Coliseum, Orville looks back at Luther and asks if he has the lock. You always bring it, Luther says.
I asked you to get it before we left the house. I said, Luther, can you get the lock? I don't want it messing up my regalia.
You seriously didn't bring it?
Fuck. What are we gonna do? I asked you right before we left the house. You said, yeah, I got it. Luther, you said, yeah, I got it.
I must have been talking about something else, Luther says.
Orville breathes out the word okay and signals for them to follow him. They hide their bikes in some bushes on the other side of the Coliseum.
Grandma will kill us if we lose our bikes, Lonnie says.
Well, there's no not going, Orville says, so we're going.
Interlude. What strange phenomena we find in a great city. All we need do is stroll about with our eyes open. Life swarms with innocent monsters. Charles Baudelaire. Powwows. For powwows, we come from all over the country. From reservations and cities, from rancherias, forts, pueblos, lagoons, and off-reservation trust lands. We come from towns on the sides of highways in northern Nevada with names like Winnemucca. Some of us come all the way out from Oklahoma, South Dakota, Arizona, New Mexico, Montana, Minnesota. We come from Phoenix, Albuquerque, Los Angeles, New York City, Pine Ridge, Fort Apache, Gila River, Pitt River, the Osage Reservation, Rosebud, Flathead, Red Lake, San Carlos, Turtle Mountain, the Navajo Reservation. To get to powwows, we drive alone and in pairs on road trips. We caravan as families, piled in station wagons, vans, and in the backs of Ford Broncos. Some of us smoke 2 packs a day if we're driving, or drink beer continually to keep ourselves occupied. Some of us, who gave up that tired life on that long red road of sobriety, we drink coffee. We sing, pray, and tell stories until we run out. We lie, cheat, and steal our stories, sweat and bleed them out along the highway, until that long white line makes us quiet, makes us pull over to sleep. When we get tired, we stop at motels and hotels. We sleep in our cars on the side of the road, at rest stops and truck stops, in Walmart parking lots. We are young people and old, every kind of Indian in between. We made powwows because we needed a place to be together. Something intertribal. Something old. Something to make us money. Something we could work toward. For our jewelry. Our songs, our dances, our drum. We keep powwowing because there aren't very many places where we get to all be together. Where we get to see and hear each other. We all came to the Big Oakland Powwow for different reasons. The messy, dangling strands of our lives got pulled into a braid, tied to the back of everything we'd been doing all along to get us here. We've been coming for miles, and we've been coming for years, generations, lifetimes, layered in prayer and hand-woven regalia, beaded and sewn together, feathered, braided, blessed, and cursed. Big Oakland Powwow. In the Oakland Coliseum parking lot, for the Big Oakland Powwow, there is one thing that makes many of our cars the same. Our bumpers and rear windows are covered with Indian stickers like, "We're still here," and "My other vehicle is a war pony," and "Sure you can trust the government, just ask an Indian." Custer had it coming. We do not inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. Fighting terrorism since 1492, and "My child didn't make the honor list, but she sure can sing an honor song." There are Schimmel Sister stickers, and Navajo Nation stickers, Cherokee Nation stickers, Idle No More, and AIM flags duct taped to antennas. There are dream catchers and tiny moccasins, feathers and beaded miscellany hanging from rear view mirrors. We are Indians, and Native Americans, American Indians, and Native American Indians, North American Indians, Natives, NDNs, and Indians, Status Indians and non-status Indians, First Nations Indians, and Indians so Indian we either think about the fact of it every single day, or we never think about it at all. We are urban Indians and indigenous Indians, Res Indians, and Indians from Mexico and Central and South America. We are Alaskan Native Indians, Native Hawaiians, and European expatriate Indians. Indians from 8 different tribes with quarter-blood quantum requirements, and so not federally recognized Indian kinds of Indians. We are enrolled members of tribes and disenrolled members, ineligible members and tribal council members. We are full-blood, half-breed, quadroon, eighths, sixteenths, 32nds, undoable math. Insignificant remainders. Blood. Blood is messy when it comes out. Inside it runs clean and looks blue in tubes that line our bodies, that split and branch like Earth's river systems. Blood is 90% water. And like water, it must move. Blood must flow. Never stray or split or clot or divide. Lose any essential amount of itself while it distributes evenly through our bodies. But blood is messy when it comes out. It dries, divides, and cracks in the air. Native blood quantum was introduced in 1705 at the Virginia colony. If you were at least half native, You didn't have the same rights as white people. Blood quantum and tribal membership qualifications have since been turned over to individual tribes to decide. In the late 1990s, Saddam Hussein commissioned a Quran to be written in his own blood. Now, Muslim leaders aren't sure what to do with it. To have written the Quran in blood was a sin, but to destroy it would also be a sin. The wound that was made when white people came and took all that they took has never healed. An unattended wound gets infected, becomes a new kind of wound, like the history of what actually happened became a new kind of history. All these stories that we haven't been telling all this time, that we haven't been listening to, are just part of what we need to heal. Not that we're broken. And don't make the mistake of calling us resilient. To not have been destroyed, to not have given up, to have survived, is no badge of honor. Would you call an attempted murder victim resilient? When we go to tell our stories, people think we wanted to have gone different. People want to say things like sore losers and move on already. Quit playing the blame game. But is it a game? Only those who have lost as much as we have see the particularly nasty slice of smile on someone who thinks they're winning when they say, get over it. This is the thing. If you have the option to not think about or even consider history, whether you learned it right or not, or whether it even deserves consideration, that's how you know you're on board the ship that serves hors d'oeuvres and fluffs your pillows, while others are out at sea, swimming or drowning, or clinging to little inflatable rafts that they have to take turns keeping inflated. People short of breath, who've never even heard of the words hors d'oeuvres or fluff. Then someone from up on the yacht says, it's too bad those people down there are lazy, and not as smart and able as we are up here. We who have built these strong, large, stylish boats ourselves. We who float the seven seas like kings. And then someone else on board says something like, but your father gave you this yacht. And these are his servants who brought the hors d'oeuvres. At which point that person gets tossed overboard by a group of hired thugs who'd been hired by the father who owned the yacht, hired for the express purpose of removing any and all agitators on the yacht, to keep them from making unnecessary waves, or even referencing the father or the yacht itself. Meanwhile, the man thrown overboard begs for his life, and the people on the small inflatable rafts can't get to him soon enough, or they don't even try. And the yacht's speed and weight cause an undertow. Then in whispers, while the agitator gets sucked under the yacht, private agreements are made, precautions are measured out, and everyone quietly agrees to keep on quietly agreeing to the implied rule of law and to not think about what just happened. Soon, the father who put these things in place is only spoken of in the form of lore, stories told to children at night, under the stars, at which point there are suddenly several fathers, noble, wise forefathers, and the boat sails on unfettered. If you were fortunate enough to be born into a family whose ancestors directly benefited from genocide and/or slavery, maybe you think the more you don't know, the more innocent you can stay. Which is a good incentive to not find out. To not look too deep. To walk carefully around the sleeping tiger. Look no further than your last name. Follow back and you might find your line paved with gold, or beset with traps. Last names. We didn't have last names before they came. When they decided they needed to keep track of us, last names were given to us. Just like the name Indian itself was given to us. These were attempted translations and botched Indian names, random surnames, and names passed down from white American generals, admirals, and colonels, and sometimes troop names, which were sometimes just colors. That's how we are blacks and browns, greens, whites, and oranges. We are Smiths, Lees, Scots, MacArthurs, Shermans, Johnsons, Jacksons. Our names are poems, descriptions of animals, images that make perfect sense and no sense at all. We are Little Cloud, Littleman, Loneman, Bull Coming, Mad Bull, Bad Heart Bull, Jumping Bull, bird, bird's head, kingbird, magpie, eagle, turtle, crow, beaver, youngblood, tallman, eastman, hoffman, flying out, has no horse, broken leg, fingernail, left hand, elk shoulder, white eagle, black horse, two rivers, gold tooth, good blanket, good bear shield, yellow man, blind man, roan horse, belly mule, Ballard, Begay, Yazzie. We are Dixon, Livingston, Sozy, Nelson, Oxendine, Harjo, Armstrong, Mills, Tallchief, Banks, Rogers, Bitsilly, Belcourt, Means, Goodfeather, Badfeather, Little Feather, Red Feather. Apparent death. We won't have come expecting gunfire, a shooter. As many times as it happens, as we see it happen on our screens, we still walk around in our lives thinking, no, not us. That happens to them. The people on the other side of the screen, the victims, their families. We don't know those people. We don't even know people who know those people. We're once and twice removed from most of what we see on the other side of the screen. Especially that awful man, always a man. We watch and feel the horror, the unbelievable act, for a day, for two whole days, for a week. We post and click links and like and don't like and repost and then it's like it didn't happen. We move on. The next thing comes. We get used to everything to the point that we even get used to getting used to everything. Or we only think we're used to it until the shooter, until we meet him in real life. When he's there with us, the shots will come from everywhere, inside, outside, past, future, now. And we won't know right away where the shooter is. The bodies will drop. The depths of the booms will make our hearts skip beats. The rush of panic and spark and sweat on our skin. Nothing will be more real than the moment we know in our bones the end is near. There will be less screaming than we expect. It'll be that prey silence of hiding, the silence of trying to disappear, to not be out there. We'll close our eyes and go deep inside, hope that it's a dream or a nightmare. Hope that in closing our eyes, we might wake up to that other life, back on the other side of the screen, where we can watch from the safety of our couches and bedrooms, from bus and train seats, from our offices, any place that is not there, on the ground. Playing like we're dead, so not playing at all. We'll run like ghosts from our own dead bodies in hopes of getting away from the shots and the loud quiet of waiting for the next shot to fire. Waiting for another sharp, hot line to cut across a life. Cut off breath. Bring too quickly the heat and then cooling of too soon death. We've expected the shooter to appear in our lives in the same way we know death is, and always has been coming for us. With its decisive scythe, its permanent cut. We half expect to feel the boom of shots firing nearby, to fall to the ground and cover our heads, to feel like an animal, prey in a pile on the ground. We've known the shooter could show up anywhere, anywhere people gathered. We've expected to see him in our periphery, a masked shadow moving through the crowd, picking people off at random. Semi-automatic booms putting bodies down, sending them flailing through the broken air. A bullet is a thing so fast it's hot, and so hot it's mean, and so straight it moves clean through a body, makes a hole, tears, burns, exits, goes on, hungry. Or it remains, cools, lodges, poisons. When a bullet opens you up, blood pours like out of a mouth too full. A stray bullet, like a stray dog, might up and bite anyone anywhere, just because its teeth were made to bite, made to soften, tear through meat. A bullet is made to eat through as much as it can. Something about it will make sense. The bullets have been coming from miles, years. Their sound will break the water in our bodies, tear sound itself, rip our lives in half. The tragedy of it all will be unspeakable. The fact we've been fighting for decades to be recognized as a present tense people, modern and relevant, alive, only to die in the grass wearing feathers.
Tony Loneman. The bullets will come from the Black Hills Ammunition Plant in Black Hills, South Dakota. They will be packed in boxes of 16, driven across the country, and stored in a warehouse in Hayward, California, for 7 years. Then stocked and shelved and bought in Oakland at a Walmart off of Hagenberger Road by a young man by the name of Tony Loneman. The 2 boxes of bullets will go into his backpack. He'll take them out again for security to check against the receipt at the exit. Tony will ride his bike down Hagenberger, across the overpass, and on the sidewalk past the gas stations and fast food chains. He'll feel the weight and hear the jangle of the bullets at every bump and crack. At the Coliseum entrance, he'll take each of the boxes of bullets out and empty them into a pair of socks. He'll swing and throw the socks one at a time against the wall behind the bushes past the metal detectors. When he's done, he'll look back up at the moon, watch the fog of his breath rise between him and everything. His heart will be in his ears, thinking about the bullets in the bushes, the powwow, and wondering how he had wound up here under the moon, under the looming Coliseum walls, hiding bullets in bushes.
Calvin Johnson. When Calvin gets there, people are doing what they always do the first hour of every powwow committee meeting he's ever been to, making small talk and dishing up paper plates of catered Mexican food. There's a new guy there. He's big and the only one without a plate. Calvin can tell he doesn't have a plate because he's one of those big guys who doesn't know how to carry his weight, how to own it. Calvin's on the bigger end of the spectrum himself, but he's tall and wears baggy clothes, so he comes off as big but not necessarily fat. Calvin sits down next to the big guy and gives him a slight, general, what's up type head nod. The guy lifts his hand and waves, then seems to immediately regret the wave because he puts his hand back down as fast as it went up and gets out his phone like everyone does now when they want to leave without leaving. Blue is writing or doodling at the top of a yellow legal pad. Calvin likes Blue. Her and Maggie used to work together in youth services. She's who got Calvin the job, even though he had no experience working with youth. She probably thought Calvin was a youth, or looks like one, with his Raiders shit and sad goatee. Blue's the head of the powwow committee. She'd asked Calvin to join the committee shortly after he got the job. Blue said they wanted fresh new perspectives. They'd gotten this pretty big event-based grant and wanted to make this powwow big, compete with other big powwows out there. Calvin had stupidly said, call it the Big Oakland Powwow, in one of the meetings, and everyone loved it. He tried to tell them he was just joking, but they kept it anyway. Thomas, the custodian, comes in talking to himself. Calvin smells it right away. Alcohol fumes. Then, as if Thomas knows Calvin smells him, he walks right past him to the big guy. Thomas Frank, he says, and sticks out his hand. Edwin Black, he says. I'll let you folks get to work, Thomas says as he takes the trash out. Let me know if you need help cleaning up the leftovers, he says with a tone like, save a plate for me. Dude is weird. Awkward as fuck, like he had to make you feel as uncomfortable as he always appeared to be, like he couldn't contain it. Blue knocks on the table twice and clears her throat. Okay, you guys, she says, knocking on the table 2 more times. Let's start. We have a lot to talk about. It's already January. We have less than 5 months. We'll start with the 2 new people, one of whom isn't here yet, so that means you'll start, Edwin. Go ahead and tell everyone a little bit about yourself and what your role is going to be here at the center. Hi, everyone, Edwin says and puts his hand up and waves the same way he'd waved at Calvin. I'm Edwin Black, and well, obviously I work here now. I mean, I guess not obviously. Sorry. Edwin shifts in his chair. Just tell them where you're from, what's your tribe and your role here, Blue says. Okay. So I grew up here in Oakland, and I'm Cheyenne. Well, I'm not enrolled yet, but, like, I will be with the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. My dad told me we're Cheyenne and not Arapaho, and sorry, I'm going to be interning for the next few months leading up to the powwow. I'm here to help with the powwow, Edwin says. We're just waiting on one more, Blue is saying when another guy walks into the meeting. Speak of the devil, Blue says. He's a young guy in a baseball cap with an indistinct tribal pattern on it. If he didn't have that hat, Calvin doesn't know if he'd have guessed he's native. Everyone, this is Dean Oxendine. Dean Oxendine, this is the powwow committee. Dean's gonna set up a storytelling booth, kinda like StoryCorps. Have you all heard of StoryCorps? They all murmur various non-committal answers. Dean, Blue says, why don't you go ahead and say a few things about yourself before we start? Dean starts to say something about storytelling, some real heady shit, so Calvin tunes out. He doesn't know what he's gonna say when it comes around to him. He'd been put in charge of finding younger vendors to support young native artists and entrepreneurs, but he hadn't done shit. Calvin, he hears Blue say.
Dean Oxendine. Dean convinced Blue to let Calvin do his interview for the storytelling project during work hours. Calvin keeps crossing and uncrossing his legs and pulling at his hat by the bill. Dean thinks Calvin is nervous, but then Dean is nervous. He's always nervous, so maybe it's projection. But projection as a concept is a slippery slope because everything can be projection. He is regularly subject to solipsism's recursive drowning affect. He set up the camera and mic in Blue's office beforehand. Blue's on her lunch hour. Calvin is sitting still now, staring at Dean mess with the recording equipment. Dean figures out what was wrong and hits record on the camera and on the recording device, then adjusts the mic one last time. Dean learned early on to record everything before and after, as those moments can sometimes be even better than when the interviewee knows they're being recorded. Sorry, I thought we were good to go before you came in, Dean says, and sits down to the right of the camera. It's cool, Calvin says. What is this again? You're gonna say your name and tribe, talk about the place or places you've lived in Oakland, and then if you can think of a story to tell, like something that's happened to you in Oakland that might, like, give a picture of what it's been like for you specifically growing up in Oakland, as a native person, what it's been like. My dad never talked about being native and shit to the point that we don't even know what tribe we are on his side. Our mom is native blood on her Mexican side, too, but she doesn't know too much about that either. Yeah, my dad wasn't home hardly ever. Then one day he was really gone. He left us. So I don't know. I feel bad sometimes even saying I'm native. Mostly I just feel like I'm from Oakland. Oh, Dean says. I got robbed in the parking lot about to go to a powwow at Laney College. It's not really a good story. I just got fucking robbed in a parking lot and then I left. I never made it to the powwow. So this one coming up will be my first one. Dean isn't sure how to help him get to a story, and he doesn't want to force it. He's glad he's already been recording. Sometimes not having a story is the story. It's like having him as a dad and not knowing, and how he fucked us up as a dad. I don't want to come off like I think that's what being native means. I know there's a lot of natives living in Oakland and in the Bay Area with similar stories. But it's like we can't talk about it because it's not really a native story. But then it is at the same time. It's fucked up. Yeah. When are you going to start recording for me to say, like, whatever I'm going to try to say? Oh, I've already been recording. What? Sorry, I should have told you. Does that mean you're going to use anything I already said? Can I? I mean, I guess. Is this shit, like, your job? Kind of. I don't have another job. But I'm trying to pay all the participants out of the grant money I got from the city of Oakland. I think I'll make enough to get by, Dean says. And then there's a lull. A silence neither one of them knows how to recover from. Dean clears his throat. How'd you end up working here? Dean says. My sister. She's friends with Blue. So you don't feel, like, any kind of native pride or whatever? Honestly? Yeah. I just don't feel right trying to say something that doesn't feel true. Well, that's what I'm trying to get out of this whole thing. All put together, all our stories. Because all we got right now are reservation stories and shitty versions from outdated history textbooks. A lot of us live in cities now. This is just supposed to be like a way to start telling this other story. I just don't think it's right for me to claim being Native if I don't know anything about it. So you think being Native is about knowing something? No, but it's about a culture and a history. My dad wasn't around either. I don't even know who he is. My mom's Native too, though. And she taught me what she could when she wasn't too busy working or just not in the mood. The way she said it, our ancestors all fought to stay alive, so some parts of their blood went together with another nation's blood and they made children. So forget them? Forget them even as they live on in us? Man, I feel you. But then again, I don't know. I just don't know about this blood shit.
Jackie Redfeather. Jackie and Harvey ride in Harvey's Ford pickup through a moon-purple desert on that stretch between Phoenix and Blythe on I-10. The drive so far has been full of long silences Jackie maintains by ignoring Harvey's questions. Harvey is not the kind of man comfortable with silence. He's a powwow MC. It's his job to keep his mouth running. But Jackie is used to silence. She has no problem with it. She'd actually made Harvey promise she wouldn't have to talk. That didn't mean Harvey wouldn't. You know, one time, I got stuck out here in the desert, Harvey says, keeping his eyes fixed on the road in front of them. I'd been out drinking with some friends and we wanted to go for a drive. A night like this would have been perfect. It's not even dark. That full moon on the sand like that, Harvey says, and looks over at Jackie, then rolls down his window and sticks a hand out to feel the air. Smoke, Jackie says. Harvey pulls out a smoke for himself and makes a vague grunting sound Jackie has heard other Indian men use before and knows means yes. I used to drink with these twins, Navajo guys. One of the twins didn't want the truck to smell like smoke. It was his girlfriend's truck. So we pulled over on the side of the highway. We'd brought a handle of tequila along. We drank too much of that, talked nonsense for a couple hours, then decided we needed to distance ourselves from the vehicle. We stumbled out into the desert, ending up getting so far out we couldn't see the truck, Harvey says. Jackie isn't listening anymore. She always finds it funny, or not funny, but annoying, actually, how much people in recovery like to tell old drinking stories. Jackie didn't have a single drinking story she'd want to share with anyone. Drinking had never been fun. It was a kind of solemn duty. It took the edge off, and it allowed her to say and do whatever she wanted without feeling bad about it. Something she always notices is how much confidence and lack of self-doubt people have. Take Harvey here, telling this terrible story like it's captivating. There are so many people she comes across who seem born with confidence and self-esteem. Jackie can't remember a day going by when at some point she hadn't wished she could burn her life down. Today, actually, she hadn't had that thought today. That was something. That was not nothing. And then, even though I can't remember having passed out on the desert floor, Harvey says, I woke up and the twins were gone. The moon hadn't moved too far, so not too much time had passed, but they were gone. So I walked toward where I thought we'd parked. It was all of a sudden real cold, like I'd never felt before, like it's cold when you're near the ocean, like it's cold in San Francisco, that moist cold that gets to the bone. It wasn't cold before you passed out, Jackie says. This is where it gets weird. I must have been walking for 20 minutes or so, the wrong way, of course, farther into the desert. That's when I saw them. The twins, Jackie says, and rolls up her window. Harvey does the same. No, not the twins, he says. I know this is going to sound crazy, but it was two very tall, very white guys with white hair. But they weren't old, and they weren't so tall that it was freakish, just maybe like a foot and a half taller than me. This is the part where you tell me you woke up to the twins lying on top of you or something, Jackie says. I thought maybe the twins had slipped me something. I knew they were Native American church guys, but I'd done peyote before, and this was not that. I got maybe 10 or so feet away from them and stopped. Their eyes were big. Not in that alien way, just noticeably big, Harvey says. Bullshit, Jackie says. This story goes, Harvey got drunk in the desert and had a weird dream, the end. I'm not joking. These two tall white guys with white hair and big eyes, hunch-shoulder, just staring off, not even at me. I got the hell out of there. And if that was a dream, then so is this, because I never woke up from it. You act like when you're drinking, your memory is what, reliable? True enough, but get this. When the internet came out, or when I started using it, I guess is a better way to put it, I looked up tall white guys in the desert in Arizona, and it's a thing. They're called the tall whites. Aliens. No joke, you can look it up, Harvey says. Jackie's phone vibrates in her pocket. She gets it out knowing Harvey will think it's to look up these tall whites. It's an unusually long text message from Opal. I already assumed you would have told me if you found spider legs in your leg, either when we were younger or when I told you about Orville's. But that assumption doesn't make sense because I found spider legs in my leg right before everything happened with Ronald. And I never told you I found those legs. I mean, until right now. I need to know if it happened to you. I feel like it has something to do with Mom. I read one website that said the tall whites are controlling America now. Do you see that? Harvey says. And Jackie feels sad for Harvey and for Opal and about these spider legs. If she'd ever found spider legs in her leg, she probably would have ended it right there and then. She suddenly feels so overwhelmed by all of it that she gets tired. This sometimes happens to Jackie, and she feels grateful when it does because most of the time her thoughts keep her up. I'm going to get some sleep, Jackie says. Oh, okay, Harvey says. Jackie leans her head against the window. She watches the white highway line stream and waver. She watches the lines of telephone wires rise and fall in waves. Her thoughts wander, loosen, reach out aimlessly. She thinks about her back teeth, her molars, how they hurt every time she bites into something too cold or hot. She thinks about how long it's been since she's been to the dentist. She wonders about her mom's teeth. She thinks about genetics and blood and veins and why a heart keeps beating. She looks at her head leaned against her head's dark reflection in the window. She blinks an erratic pattern of blinks, which ends with her eyes closed. She falls asleep to the low drone of the road and the engine's steady hum.
Part 3. Return. People are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them. James Baldwin.
Opal Viola Victoria Bearshield. Every time she gets into her mail truck, Opal does the same thing. She looks into the rearview and finds her gaze looking back at her through the years. She doesn't like to think of the number of years she's been working as a mail carrier for the USPS. Not that she doesn't like the work. It's that it's hard to see the years on her face. The lines and wrinkles that surround her eyes branch out like cracks in the concrete. But even though she hates to see her face, She's never been able to stop the habit of looking at it when she finds a mirror there in front of her, where she catches one of the only versions of her face she'll ever see, on top of glass. Opal thinks, as she drives, of the first time she took the Red Feather boys in for a weekend at the beginning of the adoption process. They were at a Mervyn's in Alameda for new clothes. Opal looked at Orville in the mirror, at an outfit she'd picked out for him. "You like it?" she said. "What about them?" Orville said, pointing at himself and Opal's reflection in the mirror. "How do we know it's not one of them doing it and not us copying? Because look, I'm deciding to wave my hand in front of it right now," Opal said and waved. It was a three-panel mirror outside the dressing room. Luther and Lonnie were hiding inside a clothes rack nearby. "She could have waved first. Then you couldn't help but copy. But look at this," he said. And then he broke out into a wild dance. Arms flailing, he jumped and spun. It looked to Opal like he was powwow dancing. But he couldn't have been. He was just trying to act crazy in front of the mirror to prove no one else was in control but him. The Orville on this side of the mirror. Opal is on her route. Same old one. But she's paying attention to where she steps. Opal doesn't step on cracks when she walks. She walks carefully, because she's always had the sense that there are holes everywhere. Cracks you can slip between. The world, after all, is porous. She lives by a superstition she would never admit to. It's a secret she holds so tight to her chest she never notices it. She lives by it, like breathing. Opal drops mail in slots and in boxes, trying to remember which spoon she'd eaten with earlier. She has lucky and unlucky spoons. In order for the lucky ones to work, you have to keep the unlucky ones with them, and you can't look to see what you're getting when you pull one out of the drawer. Her luckiest spoon is one with a floral pattern that runs up the handle to the neck. She knocks on wood to cancel out something she's said she wants or doesn't want to happen, or even if she just thinks it. She'll find wood and knock on it twice. Opal likes numbers. Numbers are consistent. You can count on them. But for Opal, certain numbers are good and others are bad. Even numbers are generally better than odd ones, and numbers that have some kind of mathematical relationship are good, too. She reduces addresses to a single number by adding them together, then judges the neighbors based on their reduced number. Numbers don't lie. 4 and 8 are her favorites. 3 and 6 are no good. She delivers mail on the odd side first,